Chapter 24. As 1960 approached, Richard Colmar was a kept husband. Depressed, having tumbled from being a successful businessman and Broadway producer to a lowly man fallen from grace. The New York Post Daily Magazine dubbed Richard a muddling amateur as a producer. His once proud reputation was in tatters, while festering beneath the surface was a strong jealousy of Kilgallen's fame and downright hatred of his wife based on a secret kept from friends and the public at large. In 1960, a Post column mentioned Kilgallen's marriage to Richard Colmar, concluding, "They go their separate ways for the most part." 5 years later, the relationship, if anything, had worsened. Richard was not the man he had been when Kilgallen married him, an alcoholic with very little means of making an income. The embarrassment Richard experienced must have been devastating and caused jealousy to invade the marriage. After all, he was a failure in business, a man with little hope, who kept up the pretenses of a happy marriage, one pockmarked with his affairs and being a drunk. Certainly his appearance had changed. He now had a bloated look to him, his face blotched at times, his eyes bloodshot, his gait unsteady. A far cry from the handsome, debonair actor and producer Kilgallen had married on April 6, 1940. Primary source evidence of Richard's philandering came from Charlotte Manson, a successful radio actress who knew both Kilgallen and her husband. She told a friend that Richard's whoring was well known. Apparently, Richard also boasted to Manson of his female conquests at parties she hosted. Richard had actually impregnated several women. His attorney, Edgar Hatfield, confirmed working out financial settlements with many of them, apparently resulting in abortions. No mention was made of whether any of Richard's conquests had a child, or if Kilgallen knew of the pregnancies. Pianist Lee Evans, who performed at Dick Colmar's Left Bank restaurant, was embarrassed by Richard's flings. Evans said Richard rented a third-floor apartment where he met the women, many one-night stands. "Dick works every night except Sunday, and I'm out at least four nights a week to cover Broadway openings and usual rounds of a columnist," Kilgallen told friends. She added, "When I'm home and Dick isn't, I occasionally have friends in. He came home at 4 a.m. and was very amused to see me let seven men out the front door. We had been playing cards. Just a couple of years ago, I learned to play poker and blackjack." Somewhat of a lost soul, Richard spent time at a neighborhood bar and prowled New York City seeking female companionship and understanding of his plight. The nightclubs he owned, the Left Bank in Manhattan and Paris in the Sky in East Orange, New Jersey, finally closed. When Richard wasn't hitting on women, he spent most of his time collecting classic Victrola records, toy banks, and sculpted hands. He mostly quit accompanying Kilgallen on the New York social scene. The starting point to understanding Richard's plight stems from interaction between family members at Kilgallen's funeral. Details were provided to readers almost immediately following the service, including from Joan Hanauer, a Journal American staff writer. She wrote in part, "They came to say goodbye to Dorothy. From Washington Heights, from Flatbush, wearing mink hats or slightly shabby cloth coats. Some, frankly, tearful. Others, solemn. But they came by the thousands." To the dismay of many, a fiery exchange between Richard and Kilgallen's mother, May, indicated that she did not believe her daughter had died accidentally. In the Journal American, the two posing for a photograph was posted. Glancing at the photo during his videotaped interview, Mark Sinclair said, "They, May and Richard, had a big fight. It says down at the bottom of the newspaper page that they are fighting, and May's pointing a finger at Richard and said, 'You killed my daughter, and I will prove it.' And Jim Kilgallen took her away." No one ever investigated May's claim. Apparently, the authorities considered her accusation simply anger from a grieving mother. If Frank Sinatra, or another disgruntled entertainment figure, did not orchestrate Kilgallen's demise, could Richard have done so? There is certainly motive aplenty, but for certain, much of his anger had to be centered around her rather bizarre romance with singer Johnny Ray, with known homosexual leanings. While Richard was chasing skirts all over Manhattan, Kilgallen had become smitten with the rock and roll singer. Exactly when the romance finally produced sexual fireworks appears to be in question, but the extent of the sexual explosion was not. The nature of the relationship was torrid, since Kilgallen and Richard had not had sex in several years. Kilgallen's friend Jean Bach noted the fireworks between the famous singer and the famous TV star and reporter, stating, "Dorothy was terribly in love with Johnny. Anything that he introduced was interesting to her. She was on cloud nine because it was all so perfect." Ray sent Kilgallen lavender roses from time to time. On her end, she gave him gifts from expensive stores, like Bergdorf's and Cartier. As noted, Ray's manager Alan Eichler stated that there was a genuine love affair, sexual in nature. Apparently, Kilgallen did little to keep her relationship with Johnny secret from Richard or anyone else. The couple was seen necking in a corner booth at P.J. Clark's. A television columnist reported seeing the two kissing at both El Morocco and the Stork Club. Whether close friend Marlon Swing had accompanied them there was unknown. But when the threesome partied together, they had nicknames. Swing was Prince Consort, Johnny was King, and Kilgallen was Princess. Choice of the restaurant was part of a game dubbed Restaurant Roulette. Included in the mix were the El Morocco, the Stork Club, Barbetta, and the Colony. At each one, the partiers would devour the most expensive meals possible and then wait to see if the check would appear on Kilgallen's table. Because of her celebrity status, it rarely, if ever, did. Noted sketch artist Robert Schulenberg caught the happy couple sharing an intimate lunch date at P.J. Clark's on 3rd Avenue. At each of these venues, Kilgallen enjoyed the adoration of fellow celebrities, who made it a point to slide by her table and say hello. She also enjoyed it when the stars of the day, ones like Judy Garland, who sang happy birthday to her one evening, or Cary Grant, who visited her home for tea, or Warren Beatty, who telephoned and played romantic piano music, made a fuss over her. After Kilgallen spent an evening on the town with Sophia Loren, she talked about it for days with friends, especially her close friend Marlon Swing. If there was one incident foreshadowing Richard's probability of having had a hand in Kilgallen's death, it was a direct result of her throwing the love affair with Ray in his face. It was one thing to frolic around the various Manhattan watering holes with Ray, but quite another to throw the affair right in his face. Day by day, the rage welled up inside Richard, and finally, that rage reached its boiling point. The ensuing confrontation began when Kilgallen and Ray appeared together one evening at Richard's Left Bank nightclub, and according to witnesses, necked in a dark corner booth. Even though the bartender was upset that Richard had to put up with the display, Richard said nothing and just ordered another drink. After midnight, at the couple's townhouse, a drunken, angry Richard discovered Ray and Kilgallen fondling each other in the black room, the family room. With fire in his eyes, Richard told Ray, "I will kill you if I ever see you two together again." Ray did not attempt to strike Richard, but instead defended Kilgallen and said it was up to her as to whether to continue the relationship. Angry herself, Kilgallen informed Richard that she wanted to leave with Ray, who later told author Lee Israel, "I thought very fast. I knew that if she were to walk out and she was ready, everything would collapse for her." Ray then explained that Kilgallen would lose the television show, the newspaper column, all that she had worked for if there was a scandal, but that Kilgallen didn't care. Apparently, Ray was able to reason with both of them and said to Israel, and I thought about Carrie. I told her, I'm going to have to walk out and leave you here. Kilgallen promised Richard she would stop seeing her lover, but she was so disturbed by what had happened. Her health deteriorated, and she missed appearing with him on their radio show for several days. Richard sank into a drunken stupor, and when he appeared on the program slurring words when he spoke, the producers at WOR Radio pulled the plug. The show was no more. After a short time apart, Kilgallen continued the affair with Johnny Ray. His biographer, Johnny Whiteside, wrote, Johnny and Dorothy began to meet out of New York City as much as possible. Whiteside then quoted Jimmy Campbell, Ray's musical director, regarding the specifics of a rendezvous in Washington, D.C., writing, We all went out that night and then came back to our hotel. John said, I'll call you when I'm finished. So about 4 hours later, I get a call, and he said, I'm down in the bar. Come on down and help me out of here. Jesus Christ, am I worn out. Campbell then added, Dorothy loved him. Before The Reporter Who Knew Too Much was published, no one considered the full significance of the Kilgallen-Ray love affair, other than how it had inflamed Richard to the point of threatening physical violence against Ray. A threat indicating the violent tendencies Richard possessed, unable to find work, drunk most of the time, an undercurrent of hatred toward his wife possessed Richard day and night. Why had Richard acted so violently toward Johnny Ray? Understanding the reason begins with Mark Sinclair's concern for her safety, shared by butler James Clement, once Kilgallen began investigating the JFK assassination through the fall-winter of 1965. In his videotaped interviews, Sinclair said Kilgallen believed people were spying on her. The hairdresser added, Yes, she knew that was happening. She wasn't worried about the phones in the Kloop, her home office. She was worried about phones in the rest of the house. And she was carrying around a big packet of papers with her that she said pertained to the JFK assassination. As Sinclair readied Kilgallen for What's My Line, he said they often simulated the game. I played it all the time with her. We would play the game. Donald Simpson was there, and we'd play the game around her. Regarding threats on her life, Sinclair answered, Yes, she told me. This is a couple of weeks before she died, or maybe 3 or 4 weeks, I'm not sure of the time anymore. But she told me she was going to get a gun, because her life was being threatened, and she was scared for her life and for her family. 2 days before Kilgallen died, Sinclair recalled, I was at her house almost every night that week, the week before she died. She was worried about her life. She said, I have to get a gun because someone's going to kill me. And I jokingly said, Oh, Dorothy, who would want to kill you? So that started a conversation. And then time elapsed over us talking about this. And she said, well, I had to draw a new will. Sinclair added, it was embarrassing to talk about her death. But we were talking about it, and she said, I don't know if Richard would take care of Carrie. He wouldn't take care of Carrie, keep Carrie close to him, and so he was going to need money. She didn't mention Jill, and she didn't mention Richard Jr. She didn't mention any of those people. She just mentioned Carrie. She said she drew up a new will and that Carrie would have a different inheritance. The will was drawn up by her lawyer, but I don't know what happened to it or who knew about it. Being afraid, buying a gun, and changing her will were, in all likelihood, triggered by an alarming incident on October 29th, just 10 days before she died. Addressing what happened, Sinclair said, Yes, after a picture of Carrie appeared in the paper, a large picture of him, alone in the middle of Central Park. She was very worried that Carrie would be kidnapped. Obviously, she didn't allow that kind of picture to be taken and be put in the paper of him all alone playing baseball. But he wasn't even playing baseball. He was just running across a field means that someone was following him. Sinclair added, Carrie's name did not appear with it, but it was frightening to her because he was alone. It's easy for Sinclair to speak of Kilgallen being frightened. but one may only imagine the scene when she discovered the photo while reading the morning paper. Note, despite extensive research, the photo has not been discovered. As a mother first, before any career choices, her blood pressure must have risen sky high. And it is not speculation to believe she may have screamed, scared as she was that her beloved son had been photographed all alone by a person or persons unknown, following him for unknown reasons. How the photo reached the newspaper, it is unknown which one, and who had made the decision to print it must have befuddled Kilgallen, and the bet is she scolded whoever had let that happen. Despite a rampage to learn the truth, in all likelihood, she fell short of finding out any answers to questions about the mind-boggling episode, especially why someone would follow her youngest son. During the October 31st, 1965 What's My Line episode, guest panelist Steve Allen introduced Kilgallen by saying, "Her little boy is out trick-or-treating by limousine. How do you like that for class?" Although Steve Allen did not mention Carrie by name, this primary source evidence seems to confirm Mark Sinclair's statements about the youngster's Central Park episode, with him adding that Kilgallen then protected Carrie due to the threats and surveillance, to the extent of not permitting Carrie to trick-or-treat on foot. What other steps she took are unknown, but it's safe to say Kilgallen made sure Carrie never stepped foot in Central Park alone again. During the same conversation, Sinclair, with some hesitation, revealed a secret, opening the door to arguably one of the most, if not the most, controversial aspects of Kilgallen's life. It focused on who was Carrie's biological father. Asked again if Kilgallen would have divorced Richard, Sinclair stated, "The marriage had been over for years. They would have stayed married. She would have never divorced him." Asked why Kilgallen would not divorce Richard, Sinclair elaborated by repeating, "I asked her why she didn't divorce Richard, and she said she could never do that to Richard, that Richard had been too kind to her, and I think that had something to do with Carrie." Asked if Kilgallen ever told him that Richard was not Carrie's father, Sinclair said, "Yes, she did. She said that Johnny Ray was the father of her youngest child." Regarding any resemblance between Ray and Carrie, Sinclair stated, "Yes, I saw a strong resemblance, coloring, freckles, things like that." This similarity in appearance coincides with Kilgallen describing Carrie in her TV radio mirror interview as a husky six-year-old with freckles across his nose who loves Dennis the Menace. Also in a September 1954 Good Housekeeping magazine article, Kilgallen wrote about Carrie's birth. Her first sentence read, "My baby has red gold hair," a stark contrast to the dark-haired Richard. In 2017, when Brenda DeJordan was interviewed by this author and informed there was evidence that Carrie was Johnny Ray's son, DeJordan said, "So that's where the red hair came from." If one compares childhood photos of Carrie with childhood photos of Johnny Ray, there appears to be significant similarities between their respective noses. While Dorothy and Richard's noses have some sharp curvature, neither Carrie's nor Ray's has that feature, but instead a more rounded shape. Providing more information about Carrie being Johnny Ray's son, Sinclair said, "And I think that Ray being Carrie's father is what she was referring to when she said she couldn't divorce Richard because Richard had done too much for her." Queried as to whether Richard had to pretend to be Carrie's father, Sinclair replied, "No, she never said that. And this was at the very end of her life that she told me this." While admitting later that Kilgallen told him Richard had performed a fatherly acting job. As to whether Kilgallen would have ever wanted the truth to be told, Sinclair said, "Oh no, I would never have repeated it. And I'm very long in repeating it now. I'm not really sure why she told me that." Several factors may be evaluated as to the likelihood that Richard was not Carrie's birth father. They include Kilgallen's friend Marlon Swing stating that she was smitten, overwhelmed by the electricity of Ray's new musical style, as early as 1952. There being little likelihood, based on the marital problems the couple had, Kilgallen's lack of respect for her husband, and the common knowledge there were no sexual relations between them, that Richard could have been Carrie's father. Sinclair stating in his videotaped interview, "I would imagine that anyone coming into the home would think Richard and Dorothy led a married life, which they had ceased to do long before the 1960s. Sinclair stating that he believed Kilgallen's affair with Ray began at the same time Sinclair first moved to New York City at the end of 1952. Sinclair stating that since Ray was gay and Sinclair's gay friends on Fire Island were proud of Ray's accomplishments, they were quick to tell Sinclair the couple was meeting in hotels while keeping the affair secret. Stand-up comedian George Hopkins, a friend of Johnny Ray, reported that Kilgallen met Ray at a 1952 press party for the singer at the New York Sheraton Astor Hotel near Times Square, and asked others what they thought of Johnny. The date of the party is uncertain, but apparently was in close proximity to Kilgallen's Voice of Broadway column, where she praised Ray's hit song, Please, Mr. Sun. Based on his conversations with Ray for the book Cry, author Johnny Whiteside wrote, "Dick had shied away from performing his husbandly duties for years, resulting in a pent-up yearning, which Dorothy released with stupendous and increasingly careless ardor." Whiteside added that Ray told him, "God, she was starved for affection. Sometimes I didn't know how to handle it." Since Carrie was born in March 1954, Kilgallen's pregnancy likely would have begun during June 1953. To date, no photos have emerged of a pregnant Kilgallen at the time. No one knows whether Kilgallen informed Richard that Johnny Ray was Carrie's birth father, but if the statements by reputable witnesses are correct, that Richard and Dorothy were not having sexual relations, he must have known. If, in fact, Kilgallen was having relations with Richard as well as Ray, complications arise as to who the real birth father was. Although the coloring of Carrie's hair and the facial similarities certainly point to Johnny being the birth father. Recall Dickie and Jill had been born 2 years apart, 1941 and 1943, and Carrie 11 years later. With little love existing in the marriage with Richard, did Kilgallen intentionally become pregnant with a man she did love at the time, Johnny Ray? Alan Eichler, Ray's manager before he died, did not believe Ray was Carrie's father. He told this author Kilgallen's lover never acknowledged Carrie as his son. In Whiteside's Cry, or in Lee Israel's Kilgallen biography, there is no confirmation of Ray being the birth father. Israel does refer at one point to Carrie being redheaded. Johnny Ray, fair-skinned, had light brown hair. A 1994 letter from Ray's sister Elma to researcher Catherine Faubel's assistant denied Ray had fathered Carrie. However, close examination of a portion of Johnny Ray's words to his intended biographer, Johnny Whiteside, describing the day in 1960 when Richard threatened to kill him, hint at Ray's knowledge that Carrie, 6 years old at the time, was his son. Recall that Ray said, "And I thought about Carrie," during the confrontation. Why would Ray say this while not mentioning Dickie or Jill, only Carrie? Perhaps it was because Carrie was so young, and the two other children much older. But if one adds to the equation that Carrie had hair that was gold reddish and not dark in nature like Richard's, and there were obvious facial resemblances between Carrie and Johnny for all the world to see, then common sense dictates Ray either knew or strongly suspected Carrie was his son. Did family members wonder whether Carrie was Richard's son? Certainly Kilgallen's parents and sister Eleanor had seen Carrie's physical appearance and knew it was a complete departure from Richard's, especially the hair color, the freckles, and the nose configuration. If they did know Carrie was an illegitimate love child, there is no record of their ever divulging the secret. Neither is there evidence that Kilgallen's friends ever questioned Carrie's birth heritage. Since Kilgallen was so intent on protecting Carrie, the idea that she would have committed suicide must be dismissed for certain. If anything, she would have wanted to remain alive to protect Carrie. Weeks following Kilgallen's death, the New York Times reported that Richard, according to her will, had inherited her entire estate with no mention of Carrie. Addressing this issue, the hairdresser said, "Yes, I read that." Asked if this meant the new will never surfaced, Sinclair said, "Yes, that's correct." Sinclair added, "There's another will somewhere. Richard must have destroyed it." Evidence does exist that Kilgallen was making plans in case something happened to her, in case her life was ended. The new will is one example, but another was a strange trip she took within 2 or 3 months of when she died. Tutor Ibn Hassan, who resided in the townhouse with Kilgallen's family, confirmed to this author Sinclair's account that she had visited Switzerland. The hairdresser recalled, "Before leaving, she set out some books and diaries and tapes and papers, and some jewelry. I think she had a safe deposit box in Switzerland." He added, "The way I know about it is that the things were spread out on the bed. They were going into a suitcase." Asked why she may have taken the items abroad with her, Sinclair said, "She didn't trust Richard financially. I don't think she would have told him that she was going to do something financially in Europe." In fact, after Kilgallen died, it was discovered that more than $10,000 worth of jewelry items had been left in a safe deposit box at the Dolder Grand Hotel in Zurich. On the estate form, the jewels were described as platinum-set earrings with diamonds, flower design. It is unknown why Kilgallen abandoned the jewels, but perhaps she included them in her revised will, intended for Carrie, so that he might benefit from the stash. Research by this author regarding any new will, why Kilgallen took various personal items to Switzerland, and whether she had a safe deposit box there, has not been fruitful. It is known that Richard must have inherited the townhouse, since he sold it in 1966, 1 year after Kilgallen died, for $290,000, more than $2 million in today's dollars. Whether the bad memories of a good marriage gone bad triggered the quick sale, or whether Richard simply needed the money to survive is unknown. Apparently, Kilgallen's various insurance policies provided him with another $90,000, and the three children shared $85,000 from a Goodson Todman production company for What's My Line, profit-sharing dividend. What happened to any of Kilgallen's cash savings is unknown, but it follows that Richard was the benefactor. Regarding what may have been available, Sinclair stated in a late 1990s videotaped interview, "The money was there. Dorothy made a lot of money. We're not talking about money in today's terms. If it was put into today's terms, it would be millions." Richard's benefits after Kilgallen's death, benefits from the crime if he was involved in her death, included royalties from Murder One when it was published 2 years later. But there was certainly a downside to her death, since Richard was the one who lost the family wage earner. Kilgallen's salaries from What's My Line, The Journal American, and other means were paying the family bills. According to the primary source information gathered by this author from Brenda DeJordan, chaos reigned among Richard and the children after she unexpectedly died. DeJordan said, "After Dorothy's death, there were a lot of not nice things going on in the townhouse. Richard was trying to give things away, and Dorothy's dad was upset. Jill wanted things, and her dad wouldn't give them to her. Jill wanted her mom's coats, so many fur coats, finer jewelry, and Dick wouldn't let her have them." DeJordan added, "I believe Dickie, Jill, and Carrie contested the will." Barely 2 years after Kilgallen died, Richard married Anne Fogarty, Kilgallen's acclaimed clothes designer. Sinclair said in his videotaped interview, "I found that marriage very strange. Certainly, Dorothy didn't know that Richard had any inklings toward Anne, or Dorothy would have told me. And Anne wouldn't have remained her friend. although I don't think Dorothy would have cared what Richard did, asked why Kilgallen's widower married Fogarty. Sinclair said bluntly, he needed the income she provided. Concerning Richard's motive to eliminate his wife, income could certainly have been a factor. In light of Richard's shaky mental state, could learning that Kilgallen planned to change her will to protect Carrie have infuriated him enough that he might cause her harm? Did Richard realize he might be destitute if he was left out of the will, causing him to consider evil actions toward his wife before she could rescind the old will and have a new one drawn up, one that would favor Carrie instead of him? Without question, something Richard must have said or done apparently spooked Kilgallen into a protect Carrie mode shortly before she died. Maybe Richard had threatened her, as he had with Johnny Ray, causing her to be frightened of him. Regardless, her belief that Richard might abandon Carrie proved to be true, as evidenced by blog entries Carrie posted on his internet blog site entitled Testing the Waters. Note, as of April 2018, the blog has been removed. Carrie admitted being thrown out of my house at age 16. This would have happened around 1970, just a bit more than 4 years after his mother died, when Carrie was sent away, as he admitted to author Lee Israel in 1975, to a foster home. A cruel act that would have broken Kilgallen's heart. Why Richard, who committed suicide a year later, kicked Carrie out of the house is unknown. But perhaps the unrest between him and his son when she died, and apparently the two other children as well, must have been the cause. The split between Richard and Carrie was predictable, based on Carrie's blog entries. He wrote that he was 11 years old when he returned home from school, St. David's, around the corner from the Guggenheim Museum, 1 mile north of the townhouse, after being told his mother was dead. He then described the scene. As I entered the black room on the third floor, I sensed, even from behind me, my father's misery. He sat as he always did, perched on the right side of one of the pair of black, silk-covered love seats, his shoulders stooped and rounded, elbows leaning on his knees, the fly of his pajama bottoms pinched open enough to make us all avert our gazes, hovering over a beer. He sipped one after the other. Carrie added, Ellen O'Hara was sure to be working today, keeping plenty cold and at the ready during this morning period. Glasses of Heineken, one after the next. Two empty bottles on the table next to the coaster that held his half-full glass. Of O'Hara, Kilgallen's youngest son wrote, the stooped, yet dynamically energetic elderly Irish woman was the kindest, warmest person in the household of my childhood. More a grandmother figure to me than my own grandmother. Her presence in my daily life was stabilizing and calming. She, perhaps more than anyone in that house, made me feel taken care of in the most elemental sense. Ellen lived to serve. He added, Ellen was the kindest woman to ever grace God's earth. Her tuna salad was legendary, utilizing sweet onions, chopped into tiny, perfect pieces, lots of mayonnaise, and the secret magic ingredient, chopped sweet baby gherkins pickles, with a bit of the pickle juice added for flavor. Regarding interaction with his father at the townhouse, Carrie recalled, I watched as he continued to stare ahead, seeing and saying nothing, feeling his pain somewhere else, far from here. I walked slowly about the table and touched his shoulder with my hand, squeezing gently, hoping for any response. Nothing. Carrie said he went upstairs and sat on the edge of my bed, thinking. I wondered what my father was thinking about. I wondered why he wouldn't talk to me, particularly in this time of death and sadness. Didn't one comfort their child when times were hard? Did he not even care about me? Or was it perhaps that he hurt so deeply that he couldn't find the words or even a gratuitous gesture? Could he not come out of himself long enough to offer a hug to his 11-year-old son, who had, after all, just lost his mother? Summing up, Carrie had written, This day would mark the beginning of the end of my respect for my father. Since Carey has not responded to this author's attempts to interview him, no denial or confirmation of Johnny Ray having been his birth father is possible. Regardless, learning of his mother's intention to protect him if she died should let Carey know of her deep love for her youngest son. Adding to the mystery of whether Richard Colmar could have been complicit in Kilgallen's death is fresh information supplied to this author in June 2017 by Brenda DeJordan. She said in part, May, Kilgallen, Dorothy's mother, didn't like Dick, Richard, from the beginning. Dick was not Dorothy's mother's choice. The entire family felt that way. I think she was engaged to someone else before him. Lots of people called Dick Mr. Kilgallen. My father called Dick a so-and-so. Dorothy had the gold mine, not Richard. Dorothy was not happy with her relationship with Dick. Jill was very hurt by how Dick acted in front of others. I knew Dorothy and Dick were estranged. Jill was angry with her dad. She demonstrated that in front of my parents. Jill talked to my parents about Dick. She came to my mom and cried. Carey went to stay with Jill after Dorothy died. Dick didn't care about any investigation of her death. He wasn't concerned. Guilt was the reason Dick died. DeJordan's comments provide a rather sad atmosphere prevailing in the Kilgallen household, both just before she died and afterward, with conflict between Richard and Dorothy apparent. Such a state of affairs permits a better understanding as to why the three children have failed to cooperate with any investigation into their mother's death. Richard's unsteady state of affairs apparently extended through the days when he was married to Anne Fogarty. Sinclair, when asked whether Richard should have been more stable, but instead continued to haunt NYC bars, including the Madison Avenue Cafe, said, It sounds like someone who is very unhappy about something. When asked whether Richard's shaky state of mind was indicative of a man who possessed the secrets to the JFK assassination through Kilgallen's files, insinuating the information she had gathered could be valuable, Sinclair said that made little sense. If Richard never confiscated the assassination file, then that something Richard was unhappy about could have been complicity in Kilgallen's death. If it was, how involved was he? When considered with other evidence from both primary and secondary sources, there appears to be a plausible means by which Richard could have ended his wife's life, based on jealousy and greed, two of the common homicide motives. Richard had the opportunity to kill Kilgallen, since not only was he in the townhouse at the time of her death, but the servants had Sunday off and did not return until after 6 a.m. Monday morning. This meant that other than Carey and Ibn Hassan, whose rooms were on the fourth floor, where noise from the third would have been difficult to hear, no one was present who could have witnessed Richard's evil actions. Key to understanding how Richard may have been complicit in Kilgallen's death, connect to the circumstances surrounding his drug use. Despite Jill Colmar swearing that her parents never abused drugs, prescription or otherwise, a different perspective regarding Richard's drug habit is provided by none other than Carey Colmar, who told author Israel, his father had vats of pills around, containers of Tylenol large enough to pickle mice. This suggests that Richard certainly had the means by which to spike Kilgallen's drink, or trick her into taking more pills than her heart could stand, since Tylenol was one of the drugs discerned in her bloodstream. During March 1965, when Kilgallen was hospitalized for a fractured left shoulder, Pearl Bauer, an assistant to Kilgallen's secretary, Myrtle Verne, said, Richard brought Kilgallen pills and liquor that damn near killed her. This statement appears to point to Kilgallen's need for drugs, but only during a time when she was in pain from the injury. There are other possible alternatives as to how the Tylenol entered Kilgallen's bloodstream, but since she did not have a prescription for that drug, a conclusion seems plausible that Kilgallen could have secured the Tuinol and Nembutal pills from Richard. One possible scenario as to how this happened is that Kilgallen, unable to sleep when she arrived home from the Regency Hotel bar, and unable to rely on Sekinol to help her get to sleep, since the vial she'd obtained from the Hunter Pharmacy was empty, called out to Richard for help. Heeding his wife's call, Richard may have provided Kilgallen with a mixture of the three drugs ultimately found in her bloodstream, while he was too intoxicated to realize the danger. To accelerate the effect, permitting her to enjoy a good night's sleep, he may have dissolved the powder into a vodka and tonic mix. Only later would he have learned that the three drugs had been a lethal dose and, by accident, he was responsible for her death. If so, his actions may have been excused by a court of law, or involuntary manslaughter could have been the verdict. In the alternative, if Richard was either in a drunken state or angry, he may have succumbed to a fit of jealous rage over Kilgallen enjoying the good life, one in which she was carrying on a second affair, this time with journalist Ron Pataki. Richard's anger could also have stemmed from the fact that he had to act like he was Carrie's birth father. In addition, Kilgallen's threat to change her will, leaving him with less if she died, could have been festering as well. In this state of mind, Richard could have fixed Kilgallen her favorite drink, vodka and tonic, and then emptied the capsules from his stash, including Sekinol, Tuinol, and Nembutal, into her drink, thus deliberately poisoning his wife. When Richard checked the bathroom after Kilgallen experienced an upset stomach, leading to her ingesting the Pepto-Bismol, the 50 cc's of pink fluid noted in the medical examiner's report, he discovered the dosage had been fatal. Knowing he was responsible for her death, and afraid of being charged with a crime, an intoxicated Richard had to think quickly regarding how to cover up his actions. If Richard accidentally on purpose or deliberately spiked Kilgallen's drink with the powerful Tuinol along with the other barbiturates, he was guilty of premeditated or second-degree murder. Perhaps a savvy defense attorney might convince a jury Richard was too drunk to know what he was doing, thus absolving him of malice or intent. But it would have been a formidable challenge. Mark Sinclair's discovery of Kilgallen's body in the bedroom a few minutes after 9 a.m. must have been a shock to Richard, since, as Sinclair, referring to Clement, stated in his videotaped interview, "I wasn't supposed to be there. I was not supposed to find the body. They didn't expect me to come. No one knew I was coming to the townhouse." Police were not notified of Kilgallen's death until mid-afternoon, long after Sinclair appeared on the scene. Phyllis Cerf, wife of Bennett, told Sinclair, "Richard was dead drunk. They were trying to sober him up." Jean Stralam, a friend of the Colmars, said, "Dick was in his chair crying, so drunk, so upset, so in tears." The question is, was Richard drunk and upset over the loss of his wife, or because he somehow was responsible for her death? If Richard had been indicted for Kilgallen's murder, any first-year prosecutor could have tripped him up based on the answers he apparently provided to Dr. Luke a short time after the medical examiner appeared on the scene. Recall that, listed under the section Witnesses or Informants, he said Kilgallen had returned home from What's My Line at 11:30 p.m. feeling chipper before writing her column, saying goodnight and going to bed. Based on other accounts, Richard's statements were blatantly false. Bob Bach had been with Kilgallen after midnight at P.J. Clark's. Several witnesses saw her at the Regency Hotel bar past that time. And Dave Spiegel, the Western Union manager, spoke to Kilgallen at 2:20 a.m. Of course, if Richard was as drunk as Phyllis Cerf and Jean Stralam described, it is a wonder that Dr. Luke even interviewed him, if he did at all. The possibility exists that Dr. Luke did not do so, but that Detective Doyle asked Richard questions and then provided Dr. Luke with the results, which Dr. Luke then noted in the autopsy report. Either man, of course, should have recognized Richard was nearly incoherent, and triggered some follow-up with those who could have provided credible information about Kilgallen's activities before she died. What is known is that Doyle never followed up on either what he learned from Richard firsthand or what was included in the autopsy report by Dr. Luke, if Doyle ever read it. Richard's account regarding what happened to Kilgallen's JFK assassination file adds to suspicion that he was involved in her death. 3 days after she died, Jean and Bob Bach invited Richard to dinner. Bob asked, "Dick, what was all that stuff in the folder Dorothy carried around with her about the assassination?" Richard replied, "Robert, I'm afraid that will have to go to the grave with me." Later, Kilgallen's friend Mark Lane, with whom Kilgallen shared her JFK assassination investigation findings, asked Richard about the file. He said, "I'm going to destroy all that. It's done enough damage already." Lane apparently did not follow up with a question as to why the file had done enough damage already. During a November 21st, 2011 interview on the popular overnight program Coast to Coast with George Noory, never examined before, Lane expanded on what Richard told him. Lane disclosed that Richard had seemed frightened when he visited with him a month after Kilgallen died, that he was aware of harm that had befallen other people who had told various authorities or journalists stories that contradicted the Warren Commission report. Regarding the Kilgallen file, Lane repeated Richard's story about destroying the file. In 2017, Kilgallen's daughter Jill told New York Post reporter Sue Adelman, "I don't know anything about that," when asked about the file. Jill added, "I never saw my mother's papers. Everything was in her hand. I didn't see her files and notes." This account appears most dubious, based on Mark Sinclair's having seen her papers, photos of Kilgallen holding papers at the Ruby trial, and her having displayed files she said included her JFK assassination investigation evidence to What's My Line colleagues at the television studio. Dallas resident Pepper Hollingsworth, a close friend of Bill Franklin, who shared a relationship with Kilgallen's lover, Johnny Ray, told this author in 2017, "I was there in the 1970s during light moments in Las Vegas when Johnny and his manager Bill Franklin sometimes reminisced about Dorothy. They said that she had avoided telling Richard where her valuable documents, including the JFK assassination documents, were located. She knew he was a mess emotionally and with his lack of a work ethic. Therefore, she did not want him to know where she kept the documents." Richard argued quite extensively against any autopsy being performed. In fact, Johnny Ray biographer Johnny Whiteside wrote of Dick's vociferous refusal to allow an autopsy. The question is whether Richard had done so out of love for his wife, wanting to avoid the nastiness of an autopsy, or because he was afraid of what the autopsy results might indicate regarding the barbiturates discovered in her blood. If it was the latter, and he had spiked her drink with the killer drugs, he must have sweated until the final medical examiner's report was issued, since he may have been so drunk he really couldn't remember what had happened. Taking all of these facts into consideration, and Richard's propensity for violence based on threatening to kill Johnny Ray, was Richard capable of murdering his wife? At her funeral, as previously mentioned, Kilgallen's mother May accused him of doing so, but no investigation resulted based on her comments. Amazingly enough, since her allegations were printed in the journal American for all to see, including Detective Doyle and Dr. Luke. Since Richard committed suicide, he cannot defend himself from any accusations, and his children, for reasons known only to them, will not comment. Based on interviews with the couple's friends, Lee Israel was dubious Richard could have murdered Kilgallen. Summarizing her thoughts, the author wrote, "He did not appear to have the balls to do a crime of such magnitude." Mark Sinclair also expressed doubt during his videotaped interview that Richard killed Kilgallen. Sinclair stated, "I don't think he could have done it." Asked if a more powerful person did, he said, "I think it was more than one person who did it, was involved in Dorothy's death." Credible information supplied by tutor Ibn Hassan in a 1978 interview also should be added to the mix. Asked about the circumstances at the townhouse just after Kilgallen's body was found, he said, Jill and her husband had come, and they were discussing different family problems, and Mr. Colmar was there, and to Jill, he said, Well, Jill, there is no argument. There was nothing. He was feeling guilty, perhaps feeling that he had done something wrong. Continuing, Hassan added, They said, Well, Dad, we are not blaming you or anything. Hassan, who confirmed that Jill and her husband remained most of the time arranging the formalities, did not comment further regarding what the family problems were, or why Jill had reason to assure her father, Dad, we are not blaming you for anything. But the statement itself triggers conjecture as to whether Jill believed Richard was somehow responsible for her mother's tragic death. What remains clear is that relations between Richard and Jill, Dickie, and Carrie deteriorated substantially during the days and months following Kilgallen's death. Brenda DeJordan had stated that Jill was upset with Richard denying her many of Dorothy's belongings, and that the three children finally had to contest their mother's will. An indication they were seeking the new will Mark Sinclair said Kilgallen told him about shortly before she died. Over 50 years later, Richard Colmar must be considered a logical suspect in his wife's death. He had motive, jealousy of her continued success, both personally and professionally, and potential loss of inheritance if she changed her will. Means, being in the townhouse when Kilgallen died with easy access to her. And opportunity, townhouse apparently empty except for Carrie and Hassan, who were asleep in their fourth floor rooms. Regarding benefit from the crime, if nothing else, Richard no longer had to be married to a woman having an affair with a second man, Ron Pataki, while being knowledgeable that during her first affair, one with a known homosexual named Johnny Ray, she had conceived a child, an embarrassment to Richard's manhood, and leading him to live life in a bottle. Any prosecutor, if Richard had been charged, could have certainly exploited his unruly, desperate state of mind, his threat to kill Johnny Ray, and May Kilgallen's funeral accusation, You killed my daughter, and I will prove it.